Good morning, you old marbleites and you live streamers out there. I hope it's hot and dry wherever you are because it is cold and, well, it's not that cold, but it is raining in New York and we are all here in our Wellingtons and trying not to drown out there. And so today we continue our talk about family values in Scripture. Last week we talked about marriage, and this week we'll talk a little bit more about virginity, which is kind of the opposite of marriage, and our Christian attitudes, biblical attitudes toward virginity, which in the Old Testament is pretty much a regrettable state. You remember we talked earlier in the term about Jephthah, the military leader in the Old Testament who promised that he would sacrifice the first person who came out to congratulate him on his victory, and it turned out to be his daughter, but he was bound by an oath to sacrifice her, so he says, remember what he said to his daughter? He said, "Oh, you have brought me very low." I don't really know that it was her fault, but anyway. And so, but what was interesting about that story was, you might recall, that when she was told what had to happen to her, that she had to be sacrificed by her father simply for coming out to congratulate him, she said, "Okay, well, since you made an oath, it's okay, do to me as you said you would. But first, let me go out with my friends, my girlfriends, and bewail my virginity." Now, that's something. If you knew you were going to die in 2 months, I don't know what you would bewail. Maybe you'd want to sow a few wild oats before you left. I don't know. But I don't think that's what would leap to my mind. But it did to her. She says, "Let me go and bewail my virginity." And so she went out into the mountains with her. So why was she bewailing her virginity? What's that about? Let's take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy 22, it's full of, well, the whole of Deuteronomy is full of laws about different things. And let's take a look at 22. It begins with talk about oxen and other animals. And pretty soon it gets along to women. And specifically virgins. We start at the 13th verse. We talk about the concern in Scripture and in traditional societies in general for a woman's virginity when she marries. Somebody start reading at verse 13 of the 22nd chapter of Deuteronomy. Here we go. A man with a mic.
Suppose a man marries a woman, but after going into her, he dislikes her and makes up charges against her, slandering her by saying, "I married this woman, but when I lay with her, I did not find evidence of her virginity." Oof. The father of the young woman and her mother shall then submit the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate. The father of the young woman shall say to the elders, "I gave my daughter in marriage to this man, but he dislikes her. Now he has made up charges against her, saying, 'I did not find evidence of your daughter's virginity.' But here is the evidence of my daughter's virginity." Then they shall spread out the cloth before the elders of the town. The elders of the town shall take the man and punish him. They shall fine him 100 shekels of silver, which they shall give to the young woman's father, because he has slandered a virgin of Israel. She shall remain his wife. He shall not be permitted to divorce her as long as he lives.
Okay, that's enough of that. Wow. Boy, doesn't that sound like a happy marriage? Oh, boy. And as a reward, she gets to remain the wife of this person. Okay. Well, maybe they won't see each other much. I hope not. Without belaboring a point, there might be children listening. We know what the evidence of virginity is. There will be a bloody sheet to display. And so the parents, in some societies, and not just back then, the mother of the bride parades the next day, parades down the streets with a bloody sheet. Well, you know, never mind. It is not our way, but it is theirs. And we see how this is so important. Why would it be important? We might say, okay, well, it's because they were really neurotic, and that may be. But of course, there would be another reason. What marriage leads to in a society like this and its primary purpose is children. And if she's not a virgin when they marry, it is possible that she will be impregnated that evening, and there will be some uncertainty about the parentage of the children. And that will be, this child anyway, the first child, and that will be dangerous for what the purpose of marriage in these societies is. And it's so important to preserve the lineage of families. And notice who gets the payment of how many shekels of silver? 100 shekels of silver. Who gets that? The girl's father, not the girl. She is given in marriage doesn't say that she enters into it with any willingness. And so she is completely powerless. And I think that's one thing that we can assert about virginity in the Old Testament is that it's powerless. You don't have autonomy here. And you're also in a dangerous position. You don't have autonomy, but if you do not remain under the protection of all these people, either your father or your husband, or your dad's dead, then your brother. If your husband dies, your brother's husband. But if you're not under the protection of somebody, some male person, you're in danger. And so one of the things that a virgin is pure and promising. That is a good thing. It's true. When we look at young people, we think, you know, their lives are ahead of them and the world is their oyster. They can be anything. But they are also fragile. And the virgin is fragile. She is in danger. Sometimes Israel herself, the nation of Israel at the time, is referred to as a virgin. Fallen is the virgin Israel, they say, after one of the conquerors has overrun the country. No more to rise. She is helpless. She does not have a protector with her. Hard for us to look back over the thousands of years we're looking back at a society so different from ours, to understand the fragility of that life. We do understand its promise, but it's also fragile. And the parade of the bloody sheets through the town shows us how fragile her life is. She's so at the whim of other people. And the story continues. Let's read one more time verses 20 and 21.
If, however, this charge is true,
what the husband said, that she was not a virgin,
that evidence of the young woman's virginity was not found, then they shall bring the young woman out in the entrance of her father's house, and the men of her town shall stone her to death, because she committed a disgraceful act in Israel by prostituting herself in her father's house. So you shall purge the evil from your midst.
My goodness. And you know that there are societies still in the modern world in which this takes place. And what's interesting to us, I think, is that in those places, such acts, a stoning of somebody who has been taken to be not a virgin at marriage, might be recorded on a cell phone. So there will be modern technology in use, and we'll have videos of it and, you know, all of that, and we'll learn about it on the internet. But here it is, what we are observing is an act that was thousands of years old, an act appropriate to a way pre-industrial society, happening in this highly technical society and recorded on our highly technical instruments. Yeah, that's right. Let's take a look. Now, here's another one. In light of the Me Too movement that is sort of sweeping the country, somebody want to read? Let's take a look at verses 22 to 30. Who's going to read verses 22 to 30? Oh, it's chapter 22 again of Deuteronomy. Again. Okay, and here comes the King James Version. I wonder if they use that lovely old word damsel. I think they may. I'm not sure. Sometimes they use it. Not a word we hear much today.
If a man be found lying with a woman married to an husband, then they shall both of them die, both the man that lie with a woman and the woman. So shall thou put away evil from Israel. If a damsel, that is, a virgin, be betrothed unto a husband, and a man find her in the city and lie with her, then ye shall bring them both out unto the gate of the city, and ye shall stone them with the stones that they die. The damsel, because she cried not, being in the city, and the man, because he hath humbled his neighbor's wife. So thou shalt put away evil from among you. But if a man find a betrothed damsel in the field, and the man force her and lie with her, then the man only that lay with her shall die. But unto the damsel thou shalt do nothing. There is in the damsel no sin worthy of death. For as when a man rises against his neighbor and slayeth him, even so is this matter. For he found her in the field, and the betrothed damsel cried, and there was none to save her. And if a man find a damsel that is a virgin, which is not betrothed, and lie with her, and they be found, then the man that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he hath humbled her. He may not put her away all his days. A man shall not take his father's wife, nor discover his father's skirt.
Oh, my goodness. There we go. Now, this is very interesting to me, because in some of the modern cultures where things like this happen, we have noticed that sometimes the innocent woman is also killed just because she has been rendered impure from having had this happen to her. But here in Scripture, there is the concept of if a woman has had a chance to call for help, but she couldn't get help because she was in the open field, it's not her fault. You shouldn't kill her. But the man gets it. If she's in the town, though, they both get killed. Why? Because she didn't call for help. This is so so pertinent today with what we're hearing in the news every day about something, because one of the things that they ask about, when people bring these accusations of sexual misconduct and violence is, well, why didn't you tell? Why didn't you call for help? We see that we go thousands of years back. Marilyn has a comment. Here comes the mic. We're going to put the mic on you so the live streamers can hear you.
What about what's happened in Ireland?
Pardon me?
What about what's happened in Ireland with the abortion?
Yeah. The people of Ireland just voted in a major reversal of Catholic power. The power of the Catholic Church in Ireland have reversed that. That's something else. So, But of course, notice that this, when the young woman gets attacked, who gets the money? Her father. It's not really an attack against her. She sort of doesn't exist. If you violate a young woman, you're really violating the rights of the man who is related to her. And that's pretty, it's hard for us to wrap our minds around, but that's how it is. Here's what you want. You want more chilling stories here on this dark Sunday morning? Let's go to Genesis 19. A lot of people think they know what the sin of Sodom was. And a term comes from that. Gay people used to be, and in some benighted corners still are, called sodomites, because of the belief that the sin of Sodom was homosexuality. The sin of Sodom isn't that. The sin of Sodom is a radical, vicious lack of hospitality to the stranger. Let's read this story. It's a horrible story. It returns Lot, who is the brother of Abraham. We're in chapter 19, beginning at the first verse. Two angels come to visit Lot, who lives in Sodom. Let's read. Here comes our iPhone King James.
And there came two angels to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom, and Lot, seeing them, rose up to meet them. And he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. And he said, "Behold now, my lords, turn in, I pray you, into your servant's house, and tarry all night, and wash your feet, and ye shall rise up early and go on your ways." And they said, "Nay, but we will abide in the street all night." And he pressed upon them greatly, and they turned in unto him, and entered into his house, and he made them a feast, and did bake unleavened bread, and they did eat. But before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round, both old and young, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot, and said unto him, "Where are the men which came into thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them." And Lot went out at the door unto them, and shut the door after him, and said, "I pray you, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold, now I have two daughters which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them as is good in your eyes, only unto these men do nothing. For therefore came they under the shadow of my roof." And they said, "Stand back." And they said again, "This one fellow came in to sojourn, and he will needs be a judge. Now will we deal worse with thee than with them." And they pressed sore upon the man, even Lot, and came near to break the door. But the men put forth their hand and pulled Lot into the house to them, and shut to the door. And they smote the men that were at the door of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves to find the door.
Okay, thank you. That's good. What a horrible story. These angels, and they don't look like the angels we see in Renaissance art with wings. There are two men, and they're visitors, but they are angels from God. And they say, no, you don't have to give us hospitality. Let us just stay in the street. And Lot says, "No, you don't want to do that." And he brings them in and treats them well. Lot shows them hospitality. The townspeople show them violence, and they want to attack them. And they even try to attack Lot. He goes out of his house to talk to the men. And they say to him, "Well, good. Well, we'll do to you even worse than we were going to do to them." And he only escaped with his life because the two angels pull him back into the house and lock the door. But what does Lot offer the men? His daughters. He says, "No, go ahead and take them." Again, we're looking at this and we think, holy cow, we are not in Kansas anymore. That is the truth. It's important for us to remember in these ancient stories that we don't always take them at face value, because sometimes what the key is hyperbole, exaggeration. So Lot is shown kind of in the same way Abraham is shown in another story about him and Isaac, being willing to give the most precious thing he has. Here is Lot being willing to give the most precious thing he has, his daughter, to preserve, to protect against the violation of a stranger. And we know this because of the attention that is given to Lot's hospitality to the stranger the first time. He brings him in and gives him food and everything like that. Yes, the attack was sexual, but the sin in biblical terms was a sin against hospitality and not what we've for centuries thought it was. Here comes a comment.
Do they teach that particular theory in seminary, that it's widespread among people that would become pastors and ministers?
Did they teach it in seminary?
Because this is the second time I've heard it, and the first person I respected immensely, so I'm on board with it.
I would say, when I was in seminary, they may not have, because it was a long time ago, but I think I would say now, and most biblical scholars
reason I'm asking is because across the flyover states, this is not a common theory.
And they would probably use the term sodomite as we have heard it used for many times. But I think it's good for, you're right. I think it's good for us to, when we take a look at these stories, to look at the levels of them. And, everybody makes up their own mind, but I think there is more to these stories than what we have heard for all our lives. You remember what happens to Sodom and Gomorrah after that. And that is that they're destroyed. And remember, Lot takes his family out, and his wife turns and looks back and turns into a pillar of salt. Landon, we have something to say?
I love John's pointing that out, because what we do in America and evolved societies, we focus on the crime that's recorded.
That's so true.
The crime is the rape or the sexual act. We overlook the misdisplay of hospitality.
That's right, the violence of it. And you had a comment as well.
No, I'm just thinking about that story that you mentioned, that we look back, like the lost wife.
Yeah.
You're thinking about the good old day. And
and that's
back,
another
that
thing.
Like...
She looks back and is punished, but which of us would not look back at our home, all of our friends, all of our neighbors, maybe some relatives, and that's punishable. That's why we have to take these stories and ask ourselves very carefully, as Landon suggested, and as more and more people think, get the stuff that's underneath them as well as the thing that is on the surface. Please.
But if that town was so evil to want to attack the strangers...
Right.
Why would Lot and his wife regret leaving that town?
Good point. Well, I guess not everybody in the town was evil. I guess, they had friends and neighbors who weren't part of that group. So then we might ask, all right, if that's the case, and only some of the people, why destroy the whole city? But the Bible is full of that. With every man, woman, and child, and animal, and beast getting killed because something has happened. So, yes.
This is just a little laugh. Well, birds of a feather flock together. Oh, that's why it happened.
Yep, that's probably what they're thinking. Let's move a little further, maybe out of this violence. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians 7. Now we're in Paul's territory, and we love Paul. I love Paul. He's a cranky fellow. I've said to you that he was a cranky Pharisee when he was just a Pharisee, and then he became a cranky Christian, and that's how he is. But let's take a look. Let's start right out chapter 7 with the first verse. Who will read? Here comes Jim.
Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is well for a man not to touch a woman.
Now we're going to stop. Just one second. Let's keep the mic, Jim. Notice the quotation marks around, it is well for a man not to touch a woman. Paul is not saying that himself. He is quoting someone. What is he quoting? He's quoting a letter he got from the Corinthians that we don't have. So they've written him for advice, which a lot of his congregations do, and they write him and they have said, oh, well, Paul, we've got a question here. It is well for a man not to touch a woman, but, and then they go on to ask a question. So Paul isn't saying that he thinks that. He's saying, I mean, he may think that, but he is quoting them. Go ahead, Jim.
But because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman should have her own husband. The husband should give to the wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but his wife does.
Okay, let's stop there, because this is interesting. There has been a little progress since the time of the readings that we just did. There is an equality here between the sexual rights of the man and the woman. That's new, something new and different. Go ahead, Jim.
Do not deprive one another except perhaps by agreement for a set time to devote yourselves to prayer and then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This I say by way of concession, not of command. I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has a particular gift from God, one having one kind and another a different kind. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is well for them to remain unmarried as I am, but if they are not practicing self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to be aflame with passion.
Okay, we're going to stop you there, but keep waiting. Or as the King James people are reading, it is better to marry than to burn. Now, those of us with a few birthdays under our belts may have forgotten the vividness of what it was like to burn, but it's clearly for Paul a very important case for marriage is the restraint of sexual desire. He believes that we're left to our own devices, we're probably going to just run amok. So it's better to just get yourself married and calm down and just keep it in home. And all right, well, that's his view. Now, of course, Paul is not married. Some first century woman is probably still thanking her lucky stars that she didn't have to marry Paul the apostle, because that would not have been a happy marriage at all. So he never marries, and we're about to find out why that is. Let's take a look at verse 25 of the same chapter, 1 Corinthians 7, verse 25. So first we've talked about marriage as containing sexual desires, which Paul sees as rampant and kind of crazy. Let's go ahead, 25 and following of chapter 7, verse 25 and following. Q, how about you? Let's hear you.
And now concerning the virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give my opinion as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I think that in view of the impending crisis, it is well for you to remain as you are. What was the impending crisis? Anybody know?
Well, the impending crisis is the end of the world.
Oh.
Paul believes that the world is going to end very soon. Uh-huh. And that many people who are living in the church now will still be living and the world's going to all come to an end. So why get married? No, you don't need to worry about that. Don't have children because This is all going to end. So that's the impending crisis. And you can certainly understand, if that's what you think, why he would think that. Please go on.
Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you marry, you do not sin. And if a virgin marries, she does not sin. Yet those who marry will experience distress in this life. And I would spare you that. I mean, brothers and sisters, the appointed time has grown short. From now on, let even those who have wives be as though they had none. And those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing. And those who buy as though they had no possessions, and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it. For the present form of this world is passing away.
Yeah, the world's going to end soon. So don't, never mind. He goes on, I want you to be free from anxieties, he said. The unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about the affairs of the world, how to please his wife. And his interests are divided. And the unmarried woman and the virgin are anxious about the affairs of the Lord, so they may be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about the affairs of the world, how to please her husband. Absent from this is any thought that the married state at all could be holy itself. It's mostly just for the restraint of evil, really, the restraint of human passions. And if anything, for Paul, it interferes with your spiritual life. So what do we think about that? Does marriage interfere with the spiritual life? Are virgins really more holy than other people? You know that one of the features of the Protestant Reformation was questioning and ultimate destruction of clerical celibacy. You know that Roman Catholic priests, and at the time of the Reformation, everybody was Roman Catholic, were celibate. And they were, many of them were monastics, but not all were, but they were all celibate and not married. This was the case, although married priests here and there persisted until well into the 13th century in Europe. So there was an honoring of clerical celibacy, but it was not universally present ever. And of course, there is the little matter of people who were nominally celibate but had aunts or cousins, and then nephews on the side. So, but certainly most Roman Catholic priests were celibate. They were not married. And that was important for the church because there would be no concerns about inheritance. The church would have everything. If you don't have any kids, the church has all your stuff. And that's good. Certainly the church was wealthy. But the Protestant Reformation, among the many other things it did, was question that and decided in favor of, I think the clergy need to have options in life. It's true today. It can be difficult, I think, for a young person to get a position in a parish if he or she is not married. Sometimes somebody who might be willing to call somebody to a church would rather they had a spouse, maybe a couple of kids, and there's something probably wrong with that, too. People need to get married so that they can have fulfilling, satisfying marriages such as God smiles upon and not to polish their resumes. But I think that can happen. What do you think? Can marriage be virginity or marriage? Who will win? There are a lot of people here who have not married and had fulfilling lives and have had certainly fulfilling lives professionally and personally with friendships and also have been able to give a great deal of themselves to their spiritual lives precisely because, Paul was right, You don't have competition for that, and there's something to be said for that. Q, you had a thing you needed to say.
Something. I had a question about something else.
Okay. Virginity or marriage, who will win? Anybody have a thought about Paul's idea that maybe it's better to be alone? Or the later idea that marriage is always better, which of course is also an earlier idea. The Old Testament people thought everybody had to get married. You think about that. Is Paul right that it is easier for someone who does not have, here we have somebody here. Right here. Thank you.
Well, I think if you feel that the world is going to end any minute, that is definitely, it's more than a small consideration.
It would be.
Why bother?
That's right. That's definitely what he thought. And that's what the people in the early church thought. And I think that's why it's a good place for us to leave these texts. But Marilyn has a point. It's important for us to remember that they thought that and it influenced how they behaved.
Just a comment. Nowadays, people don't get married. They have babies, and marriage is sort of now an option, but a lot of people...
People do a lot of different things today. Yeah. And this drives some people crazy, but a lot of people, it doesn't drive crazy. A lot of people think, you know, there probably should be options. My friends, we have time for one more, and it's from Jim. The reason we have to stop early is because there's a wonderful concert upstairs, and I want the live streamers to get it, and I want us to get it.
Back to the text of Paul, it's reminiscent of Ecclesiastes, where there's a time for every purpose under heaven.
Quickie.
That last sentence that I read says, "For the present form of this world is passing away." What's the evidence that St. Paul is working with, that the world is going to change?
Well, he's looking at lots of texts from Scripture. He's part of a movement of people who believe this in the first century. People who think the world is ending always find evidence for that. This happens every once in a while. They all think it's ending, and then they sell all their stuff, and then it doesn't end. So they had the same evidence then that they have now. Okay, you people. I don't know a song to sing. We're going to hear some great music upstairs. Let's go listen to that. Goodbye, you live streamers. Don't do anything I wouldn't do.